Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor. Great to be here.
Today, we're joined by our chief analyst, Sam, and we have quite a day ahead of us.
We really do. The sources today are well packed. We're looking at a pretty major internal crisis brewing at the Federal Reserve, and then there's the staggering financial engineering happening around the global AI race.
Uh-huh.
Some of it seems, frankly, a bit dangerous.
Absolutely. And that's our mission today, right? To cut through all that complexity. We're going deep, specifically unpacking the key stories from the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, November 12th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to give you, our listener, a really thorough, detailed, and comprehensive guide. We want to look at the biggest movements in policy markets, global strategy.
Finding those connections, the strategic angles, the insights that tell the real story behind the headlines.
Exactly. So before we dive in, let's quickly set the scene with the markets. It was a bit of a mixed bag, wouldn't you say? It suggests some real uncertainty.
Definitely. The Dow Jones did well, up 1.11%, closing at 427.96.
Strong number there.
Yeah. And the S&P 500 eked out a small gain, up 0.2%. But the NASDAQ, the tech stocks, they fell 0.3%. So some caution there, especially around growth.
Okay. And commodity.
Pretty minor shifts. Oil closed at $61.04, up a little. Gold settled at $4,106.80.
And the big one. The treasury yield.
Right, the 10-year treasury yield.
Hmm.
It closed at 4.109%. Mm-hmm. That's often seen as a signal of, longer-term economic anxiety.
So those are the numbers on the surface. But the anxiety, the tension driving those numbers, that seems to be rooted in policy gridlock, which brings us straight to our first major topic, the fractures inside the U.S. economy.
Exactly. And the biggest story domestically has to be this deep, really quite significant split emerging within the Federal Reserve about interest rate cuts.
This isn't just the usual disagreement, is it? The Journal described it as having little precedent under Powell's leadership.
That's right. It's been nearly 8 years for Jerome Powell as chair, and this kind of open division is, unusual.
So what's the core of the split? It seems like a fundamental disagreement about what the biggest threat is.
Precisely. It boils down to risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the hawks, who are primarily worried about persistent inflation sticking around.
Right.
And then you have the doves, who are looking at the labor market, seeing signs of sluggishness, and worrying more about a potential recession if rates stay too high.
And this disagreement seems to have really blown up the consensus they thought they had just a couple of months ago.
Totally. Back in September, remember, a slim majority, 10 out of the 19 FOMC officials, they'd actually penciled in rate cuts for both October and December.
Okay.
But by the time they met in late October, that hawkish group had really dug in their heels. They pushed back hard, making that planned path basically impossible.
And that's when we saw Powell publicly push back against market expectations for that December cut, right? That very blunt, far from it statement.
Exactly. He wasn't just trying to manage market expectations. You got the sense he was also managing a committee that was just deeply divided on the basic state of the economy. He had to signal that things were not settled.
And didn't the government shutdown make all of this worse?
Oh, absolutely. That 6-week shutdown created what the Journal calls a data blackout. It stopped the official employment and inflation reports right when the Fed needed them most.
So they were flying blind, essentially.
Pretty much. When you don't have the hard official data, officials have to rely on private surveys, anecdotes, maybe some regional Fed reports, and let's be honest, probably their own existing views.
So the doves couldn't point to definitive new proof the labor market was weakening.
And the hawks could argue, hey, we might come out of this data fog in early 2026 and find out inflation is running way hotter than we thought, and then we'll have to slam on the brakes even harder.
Yeah.
The shutdown just poured gasoline on those existing differences.
Okay, so this whole policy mess seems to hinge on three big economic questions they can't agree on. Let's break those down. What's the first one?
The first one is about tariffs and price increases. Specifically, what happens next?
Right, the tariffs mostly on Chinese imports.
Exactly. The hawks are worried that businesses, which might have absorbed those costs initially to keep customers happy, are inevitably going to start passing them along next year.
And if that happens, inflation stays high, maybe gets structural, and the Fed has to stay restrictive.
That's the hawk argument.
Mm.
But the doves look at the same situation and draw the opposite conclusion.
How so?
They argue that the fact businesses aren't passing along those costs right now, or are very hesitant to, is actually a sign that consumer demand is weak.
Ah, so businesses can't raise prices much because they'll lose sales.
Precisely. So for the doves, this weak demand means cutting rates is actually necessary to support the economy, because high rates are just making things worse, choking off that already weak demand. It's a really fundamental disagreement about consumer strength.
Okay, that's clear. What's the second major point of contention?
It's all about the labor market slowdown. We've seen a pretty sharp drop in monthly payroll growth, right? From an average of about 168,000 jobs a month in 2024,
Yeah.
down to just 29,000 on average for the 3 months leading up to August. That's a huge drop.
So the question is why?
Exactly. Is it weak demand? Businesses are cutting back on hiring because sales are slowing down. Or is it weak supply? Maybe factors like reduced immigration mean there just aren't enough workers available.
And the policy answer depends entirely on which one it is.
Enormously.
Yeah.
If it's weak demand, keeping rates high could easily tip the U.S. into a recession. It's the classic policy mistake.
But if it's weak supply,
Then cutting rates to boost demand could be dangerous. You'd be pouring fuel on the fire, trying to stimulate demand when the economy can't produce enough supply, which could reignite inflation.
and the data blackout makes it almost impossible to tell the difference right now.
That's the core problem. They need different policy responses depending on the cause, but they can't definitively diagnose the cause.
Okay, and the third key question.
This one's about how restrictive interest rates actually are right now. They're currently in that 3.75% to 4% range.
Right.
The hawks argue that after cutting rates by half a percentage point earlier this year, rates are now pretty close to the neutral level.
The theoretical rate that doesn't boost or slow the economy.
Correct. And if rates are already neutral, the hawks say, any further cuts would actually stimulate growth and inflation. So they're very hesitant.
But the doves disagree.
The doves insist rates are still restrictive. They point to things like tight lending conditions, maybe slower credit card usage.
And if rates are still restrictive,
Then the Fed has room to maneuver, right? They can cut rates to support that weakening labor market without immediately triggering runaway inflation. It's a crucial distinction that really frames the whole debate.
we saw San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly make this case pretty strongly, didn't we?
We did. She argued that slowing wage growth is clear evidence of falling labor demand, not just supply issues.
And she had that warning about focusing too much on the past.
Yeah, she basically warned the Fed, don't be so obsessed with avoiding a repeat of the 1970s inflation, which is the historical ghost haunting the hawks, that you accidentally choke off a potential 1990s-style productivity boom.
Sacrificing jobs and growth now because you're scared of history.
That's the essence of her argument. It frames the current caution as potentially missing a big opportunity.
Wow. That's a really powerful critique. It suggests the Fed might be paralyzed by its own institutional memory. Okay, so moving from those internal Fed debates to the actual data we do have, particularly from the private sector, are the doves' concerns about the labor market holding up?
Unfortunately, it looks like they might be. The reports coming out from private payroll processors during this government data vacuum are pretty concerning.
Like the ADT numbers, they're doing more frequent reports now, right?
They are, and they released a really stark figure. They estimated the U.S. actually shed an average of 11,250 private sector jobs a week in the 4 weeks ending October 25th.
Shed jobs. Wow. That goes
Yeah.
against the narrative of a strong labor market.
It really does. It suggests things were struggling, maybe more than we thought, in the second half of October.
And that ADP metric is crucial right now, given the lack of official data. What about looking forward, especially holiday hiring? That's always a big indicator.
And that picture looks even bleaker, honestly. We're seeing extreme caution from companies in retail, transportation, warehousing, the key holiday sectors.
How does it compare to last year?
The contrast is pretty staggering. In the last 3 months of 2024, those sectors added, get this, 912,000 jobs. Massive seasonal hiring.
Okay. And this year?
This year, silence. Major companies like UPS, they hired 125,000 last year, haven't announced anything. Macy's, 31,500 last year, nothing. Target, 100,000 last year, also quiet.
That silence is deafening. Is anyone tracking the actual announcements?
Yes, Challenger, Gray, and Christmas does. Their tally through October shows large companies have only announced plans for about 372,520 seasonal hires this year.
And last year at this time,
It was 660,150. This year's number is the lowest since they started tracking this back in 2012. It signals a major pullback in corporate confidence heading into the crucial holiday quarter.
and what does this mean for people looking for work?
It means pain. One economist called it an oddball balance. You've got fewer job openings, but something like a 27% increase in people looking for holiday work compared to last year,
So way more competition for fewer jobs.
Exactly. It's become intensely competitive.
The Journal had that story about Meredith Carbonell in Queens.
Yeah, a tough situation. 37 years old, lost her full-time job last year around the holidays. She's applied everywhere, Kohl's, Target, the big names. Still hasn't found anything this season, watching her savings just disappear.
And it's not just the big retailers, right? Even smaller places are seeing it.
Right. That marketplace in Massachusetts mentioned seeing far more applicants than we've ever gotten before. And interestingly, more middle-aged, maybe overqualified candidates applying for basic seasonal jobs. People are scrambling.
So why are companies so cautious? Is it just about consumer spending?
That seems to be the root cause.
Yeah.
Companies are pulling back because they're worried Americans just aren't going to spend as much this holiday season.
Do we have numbers on that?
We do. That Deloitte survey found expected holiday spending is averaging $1,595 this year.
Which sounds like a lot, but how does it compare?
It's down significantly from $1,778 last year. That's a noticeable drop.
And that University of Michigan poll.
Yeah, that one was striking. 71% of people polled in October expect higher unemployment over the next year.
71%.
That's the highest level of pessimism on that question since 1980. Think about that, comparable to major recessions. People are feeling pinched and anxious.
And that anxiety, that caution, it feeds right back into the policy uncertainty we started with. Which brings us back to the direct costs of that policy gridlock, the government shutdown itself.
Yeah, the economic drag from that six-week shutdown was significant, even if it's hard to nail down the exact final number. The CBO estimated it would knock about 1.5 percentage points off annualized GDP growth in the fourth quarter.
That's a big hit. Where does that drag come from?
It's multiple things. You have furloughed federal workers cutting back their spending, obviously. Then there were delays in things like SNAP payments, which hits grocery spending immediately. And just the general uncertainty makes businesses pause investment plans.
Do economists think the economy gets that lost output back eventually?
Most of it, yes, once the government reopens and back pay goes out.
Yeah.
But there's usually some permanent loss. Gregory Dacco estimated maybe 20% of the hit is just gone forever. Things like missed restaurant meals or canceled services that you just can't recover.
Okay, so real economic costs. But beyond the economics, there was that explosive story about controversy within the government, specifically around Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right. This involves Bill Pault, the Trump appointee who heads the FHFA, the regulator, and also chairs the boards of Fannie and Freddie themselves. A lot of power there.
And the story is about ousted watchdogs.
Exactly. The chief ethics officer and the general counsel at Fannie Mae were apparently pushed out. And the Durham reports they had been internally investigating whether Pault had improperly obtained mortgage records.
Mortgage records of whom?
Key Democratic officials. The most prominent name mentioned is New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Wait, the head of the agency that oversees mortgages potentially accessing the private mortgage records of a political opponent.
That's the allegation being investigated. It's an astonishing claim.
What happened with that internal probe?
It was serious enough that it got escalated first to the FHFA's own inspector general, and then it was passed on to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern Virginia.
And isn't that the same office that's already prosecuting Letitia James?
It is. They brought a criminal case alleging mortgage fraud against her, which she called baseless and politically motivated retaliation by Trump.
And Pault has apparently made similar referrals about other Democrats.
The sources mentioned Senator Adam Schiff and even Fed Governor Lisa Cook as others whose records might have been involved in similar probes initiated by Pault.
The implications here for Fannie and Freddie seem huge, especially if the administration wants to take them public eventually.
Absolutely massive. How do you convince investors these institutions are stable and trustworthy if their leadership is embroiled in scandals about potentially misusing financial records for political purposes? It makes any potential IPO exponentially harder.
Okay, so turmoil inside the agencies. What about broader White House policy? There was talk about curbing the power of proxy advisors and index funds.
Yes, this is another significant move being explored. The White House is actively looking at ways to limit the influence of firms like ISS and Glass Lewis, the big proxy advisors.
The ones Elon Musk called corporate terrorists.
Right. And also the giant index fund managers, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street.
The big three.
Exactly. The proposals could include things like banning proxy advisors from making recommendations on companies they've consulted for, addressing that conflict of interest concern, or even a broader ban on recommendations altogether.
And for the index funds, they control huge chunks of major companies.
They do, often 30% or more combined. Activist investor Carl Icahn calls them a cartel. The really interesting proposal here is to potentially force these index managers to vote their shares in line with how their end clients choose to vote if those clients opt in.
So instead of BlackRock deciding how 30% of Exxon votes, the power flows back to the pension funds or individual investors who actually own the index fund shares.
That's the idea. It would dramatically curtail the centralized power these few firms have over corporate governance. They've started investor choice programs, but the White House seems to think that's not enough and is considering more forceful systemic changes. Clearly, a lot of skepticism about these powerful intermediaries.
Okay, so we have this backdrop of economic fragility, policy paralysis, deep political intrigue. It feels like the perfect setup for discussing the other massive story, the high-stakes, high-leverage world of the global AI arms race.
It really is. And the contrast between the two biggest players here is just stunning. We're talking about Anthropic and OpenAI.
The two most valuable AI startups in the world, right? Anthropic at $183 billion valuation, OpenAI at a staggering $500 billion.
That's right. And the Wall Street Journal got hold of their financial roadmaps, and they reveal completely different philosophies. It's efficiency versus aggression.
Let's start with Anthropic. They seem to be taking the cautious route.
Very much so. Anthropic, founded by Dario Amodei, who left OpenAI after disagreements with Sam Altman, is focused on a measured path. They expect to break even in 2028.
How are they planning to get there?
They're really focused on corporate customers. That's already about 80% of their revenue. And they're deliberately avoiding the super high-cost, chip-hungry stuff like generating images and video. They want high-margin, business-focused sales.
And their spending reflects that, their burn rate.
It does. It's forecast to be around 70% of revenue in 2025, which is still high, but then it drops dramatically down to just 9% by 2027. They're aiming for a sustainable long-term business model.
Okay, so that's Anthropic. Now, OpenAI sounds like the opposite approach.
Complete opposite. Maximum aggression, maximum scale, maximum spending. Mm-hmm. OpenAI is forecasting operating losses in 2028 to hit, well, an unbelievable $74 billion.
$74 billion in losses in 1 year.
Yes. And that's projected to be about three quarters of their revenue for that year.
Wow.
By the time they expect to finally turn a profit, maybe around 2030, they anticipate burning through about 14 times as much cash as Anthropic will have.
What's the rationale for that level of spending? It's Sam Altman's gamble.
It's absolutely Altman's high-risk, high-reward strategy. He wants OpenAI to set the pace for the entire field, to basically secure the future of AI development and become this multi-trillion dollar behemoth.
And it all comes down to compute power, chips and data centers.
That's the bottleneck. OpenAI is making enormous upfront bets on buying chips, building data centers, and even reserving massive amounts of future capacity for research they haven't even planned yet. The Journal reported they're spending nearly $100 billion just on backup data center capacity.
$100 billion on backup, just in case.
Just in case they need it for some future breakthrough or unforeseen demand surge. Altman's view seems to be that the risk of not having enough compute power when you need it is far greater, and maybe even more likely, than the risk of having too much and wasting money.
But if the AI market cools off, or if the technology changes rapidly and makes their current hardware obsolete.
That's the massive gamble. That whole strategy could implode spectacularly. And it would put incredible stress on the financial structures being built right now to fund all this.
Which leads us right into that funding discussion, this $1.4 trillion infrastructure race and the financial wizardry involved.
Yeah, wizardry is a good word for it. Tech giants are pushing Wall Street and private equity to come up with really complex, innovative, and sometimes pretty risky ways to bankroll these unbelievably expensive AI projects.
And the financiers are demanding some serious guarantees in return.
Absolutely. Let's look at Meta's big Hyperion data center deal in Louisiana. They structured it as a joint venture called Beignet Investor.
Beignet Investor.
Analysts are calling it a Frankenstein financing.
Why Frankenstein?
Because it stitches together pieces from different worlds. You've got private equity from Blue Owl Capital putting in $3 billion for an 80% stake. You've got structured project finance elements. And then you have this massive $27 billion bond issuance.
$27 billion in bonds. Who bought those?
PIMCO bought a huge chunk, $18 billion worth. And these bonds mature way out in 2049.
Okay, so long-term debt. What's the twist here? What makes it Frankenstein?
The really interesting part is Meta's lease arrangement. Meta gets the option to exit its lease on this massive data center every 4 years.
That seems like a huge advantage for Meta. keeps the long-term liability off their main balance sheet.
Exactly. It improves their financial metrics, makes them look less indebted. It's very valuable from an accounting perspective.
But what do the investors get in return for giving Meta that escape hatch?
They get what the journal calls an extraordinary protection. Meta guarantees to make the investors whole if the lease is terminated early.
So if Meta walks away after, say, 8 years, and the specialized AI equipment in that data center is suddenly worth way less because technology moved on, Meta eats the loss.
Precisely. Meta is essentially guaranteeing the future value of those assets, taking on billions in potential long-term liability in exchange for those short-term balance sheet benefits and the flexibility of the lease structure. It's a massive bet on the long-term value of their AI hardware.
Okay, that's Meta. How does the OpenAI Oracle deal compare the Stargate Jacquard data centers?
That's a $38 billion project spanning Texas and Wisconsin. It's financed differently by a big lending syndicate, over 30 banks involved.
And what secures that debt?
It's backed by Oracle's 15-year lease payments. Oracle is essentially the landlord and the anchor tenant here, leasing capacity to OpenAI.
What's the interest rate on that debt?
It's pretty high, 6.4%. That's significantly more than Oracle pays on its own regular corporate bonds.
But there's a complication with the rating, right?
Yes, this is crucial. J.P. Morgan, who arranged the deal, only got a credit rating from Kroll, which is a smaller rating agency, not one of the big three, S&P, Moody's, or Fitch.
Why does that matter so much?
It matters because the banks who lent the money are having trouble selling this debt off their books. The huge market for collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, which manage like $1.3 trillion, generally can only buy debt rated by those top three agencies.
So because this debt only has a Kroll rating, the banks are stuck holding it?
Largely, yes. They're holding this very specialized, high-interest, concentrated risk related to AI data centers on their own balance sheets. It's harder to distribute that risk, which could become a problem if the market turns or if they need liquidity.
Okay, one more funding example. Elon Musk's xAI. They need a fortune just for chips, right?
Absolute fortune. Just for their second big data center, Colossus 2 in Tennessee, they need $18 billion just to buy the 300,000 NVIDIA microchips required.
$18 billion just for chips. How are they funding that?
This might be the riskiest structure of all. Antonio Grassas's firm, Valor Equity Partners, set up a special vehicle called Valor Compute Infrastructure.
Okay.
This vehicle borrows billions in debt arranged with Apollo Global Management specifically to buy those NVIDIA chips. And the debt pays a massive 10.5% interest rate.
10.5%? Wow, what's backing that debt? How do the equity investors make money?
Here's the gamble. The equity returns depend almost entirely on the resale value of those NVIDIA chips after 5 years.
So they're betting that these incredibly expensive specialized chips will still be worth a lot in 5 years.
Exactly. It's highly speculative. It assumes the current frenzy for AI chips continues, that technological obsolescence doesn't crater their value faster than expected. If that bet goes wrong, that high leverage, high interest debt structure could face, well, severe stress.
This desperation for chips, for compute power, it really underscores the arms race dynamic, especially with China.
Absolutely. It's a direct consequence of this global AI Cold War.
People inside the industry really saw ChatGPT's launch as a wake-up call for China, didn't they? A Sputnik moment.
Universally. It was this sudden, stark realization that the U.S., through companies like OpenAI, Google, and critically, NVIDIA supplying the chips, had surged ahead in what looked like the most important technology of the future.
And China's leadership reacted immediately.
They did. They'd been focused on AI since 2017, mostly for industrial use and surveillance, but this shifted things to high gear. They recognized the huge risk of falling further behind, especially with U.S. export controls cutting off access to the most advanced chips.
So the state-led model kicked in. More funding, relaxed rules.
Exactly. A huge push to install computing power became a national priority. And they are making progress. There's a startup called DeepSeek that apparently created a model nearly as good as OpenAI's best, but at a fraction of the cost. But the chip shortage is still the crippling factor.
How bad is that shortage?
It's so acute that Beijing is reportedly intervening directly in how the limited supply from SMIC China's biggest chip maker gets allocated. They're prioritizing the national champion, Huawei.
And Chinese officials admit they're behind.
Privately, yes. They acknowledge maybe a decade gap in the core manufacturing technology compared to the US or Taiwan.
So what are they doing to compensate? They have these workarounds.
Ingenious, massive workarounds. Huawei is working with other local companies to literally bundle thousands, sometimes even up to a million, less powerful chips together into these huge complex systems.
Trying to match NVIDIA's power through sheer quantity.
Right. Industry analysts are calling it the swarms beat the titan strategy.
But that must use incredible amounts of power.
It does. And that's where local governments are stepping in, subsidizing the massive electricity bills for data centers, but only if they use these domestic chip systems.
And smuggling is still happening. People trying to get NVIDIA chips in.
Oh, yes. The Journal mentions reports of at least 16 NVIDIA Blackwell racks, the really high-end stuff being shipped in pieces and reassembled inside China, set for delivery just about now. The demand is intense.
But even with all that effort, the scale difference is still enormous.
The numbers are stark. U.S. production of chips comparable to NVIDIA's latest, the B300, is estimated to be nearly 25 times China's output this year.
25 times.
And that gap is projected to widen even further next year, to maybe 40 times.
So the U.S. export controls are working, essentially.
It certainly looks that way. Experts argue it's forcing Chinese chip fabs to use older, much less efficient manufacturing processes. That Morgan Stanley analysis you mentioned was striking.
About the failure rates.
Yeah, estimating that if Huawei tries to make its advanced 910C chip using Samsung's older tech, maybe 95 out of every 100 silicon wafers produced could be defective and unusable. The cost and waste are just astronomical.
As this tech gap widens, what are the geopolitical risks? More hacking.
That seems likely. Paul Triolo, a tech policy expert, warned that the costs of this AI Cold War are already high and are going to go much higher. It feeds on mutual distrust, becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Meanwhile, U.S. tech giants are expanding globally, building out capacity in Europe.
Absolutely. Microsoft investing over $10 billion in Portugal with NVIDIA. Google spending $6.8 billion in the UK, expanding in Germany too. They're cementing their lead by building out infrastructure in allied nations, bolstering AI capacity across Europe.
And there was that interesting note about Yann LeCun potentially leaving Meta.
Right, LeCun, a real pioneer in the field, head of AI at Meta for over a decade. He's apparently discussed leaving to start his own company focused on something called world models.
Which is a different approach than Meta's current focus on large language models.
Exactly. It just shows that even at the very top, among the founders of the field, there's still intense debate about the best path towards artificial general intelligence. The intellectual ferment is still very high.
Okay, that's a really comprehensive look at the AI race, the finance, the tech, the geopolitics. Let's shift gears now to more traditional global flashpoints, resources, and trade, starting in South America.
Right, we have Argentina making this huge, potentially transformative bet on copper mining.
Led by their libertarian president, Javier Milei.
Exactly. He's rewriting Argentina's investment rules, trying to shed its reputation for red tape and instability, specifically to attract massive investment in copper.
What copper?
Because demand is booming globally. You need vast amounts of it for electric vehicles, for wind turbines, for the whole green energy transition.
And Argentina has potential.
Huge potential. It hosts 4 of the world's 12 biggest undeveloped or greenfield copper projects. If those come online as planned, by 2035, Argentina could be producing over 1 million tons a year.
Making them a top global producer.
Essentially top 5, right up there rivaling neighboring Chile. Milei is banking on this to diversify their economy away from just agriculture, create jobs, and critically, bring in badly needed U.S. dollars. He's the one who boasted about having dollars coming out of our ears.
Okay, so Argentina's focused on mining wealth. Elsewhere in the region, though, military tensions seem to be rising, particularly near Venezuela.
Yes, the arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford Carrier Strike Group is significant. This isn't just a couple of patrol boats. This is a major naval force, including destroyers armed with Tomahawk cruise missiles.
And the official reason is drug trafficking.
That's the stated mission, disrupting cocaine smuggling in small boats. But the sheer firepower of a carrier strike group seems like overkill for that mission.
So the interpretation is that it's really about putting pressure on Maduro's government in Venezuela.
That's widely seen as the underlying message. And these U.S. boat strikes, they've conducted 19, apparently killing 76 people, are already causing regional friction and debate about their legality.
You mentioned Colombia pushing back.
Right. President Petro of Colombia said his country would suspend security dealings with the U.S. as long as these controversial boat strikes continue. So it's definitely destabilizing regional relationships.
Okay, bringing the energy focus back home for a second. The Trump administration is looking to open up more offshore drilling.
Yes, they're reportedly poised to unveil a plan that would allow new oil drilling off the coast of California and also in parts of Alaska and the eastern Gulf of Mexico.
This would reverse bans put in place by the Biden administration right at the end of their term.
Correct. It's a major reversal of environmental policy, and you can bet it will trigger immediate high-profile lawsuits, especially from states like California. A big fight is brewing there.
Okay, shifting to trade strategy now, specifically China. They're talking about easing the flow of rare earths.
It's a nuanced move. China plans to use something called a validated end user, or VEU system. It's modeled on procedures the U.S. already uses for its own export controls.
How would it work?
In theory, it would fast-track export approvals for certain restricted materials, like rare earths, but only for purely civilian companies in the U.S.
Ah, so the catch is military ties.
Exactly. The system would explicitly exclude any company with connections to the U.S. military. This is Beijing's core concern. They don't want their critical materials ending up in American weapon systems.
What does that mean for big U.S. companies like aerospace or auto manufacturers that have both civilian and defense divisions?
It could get very complicated and expensive for them. If China enforces this strictly, these companies might have to completely segregate their supply chains, one for civilian products using Chinese materials, another for defense products using materials from elsewhere. That's a huge logistical headache and cost.
So it's a diplomatic move that forces U.S. companies into a tough spot. Choose sides or spend a fortune restructuring.
Pretty much. It follows that recent truce where China agreed to ease exports overall, but insisted on ensuring sensitive materials didn't reach U.S. military suppliers.
Okay, let's turn to some regional conflicts and stability issues. Tensions seem to be high again between India and Pakistan.
Very high. Pakistan publicly blamed India-backed militants for a deadly suicide bombing in Islamabad that killed 12 people.
And this came right after an explosion in New Delhi.
Yes, a car bombing in New Delhi killed 8 people just days earlier. India, of course, furiously denied Pakistan's accusations as baseless and unfounded.
And accused Pakistan of deflection.
Right, saying Islamabad was trying to distract from its own internal problems. Given the history between these two nuclear powers and past cross-border violence involving militant groups, this kind of rhetoric in these events are always deeply concerning.
Definitely something to watch. Back in South America, Chile's election presents a really interesting picture, doesn't it? Extremes on the ballot, but maybe stability underneath.
It's a fascinating paradox. You have a presidential runoff between Jeanette Jara, who is literally a card-carrying member of the Communist Party,
versus José Antonio Kast, who is described as far right.
Exactly. On the surface, it looks like extreme polarization. But the key insight from the sources is the convergence.
Worming.
Meaning, neither candidate is actually proposing radical, sweeping changes to Chile's fundamental market-oriented economy or its political structures.
So the institutions are holding.
It suggests they are. Chile has constitutionally embedded fiscal responsibility rules, and it seems those are acting as guardrails against the kind of populist extremes we've seen elsewhere.
And both candidates have moderated their positions.
Significantly, Jara dropped earlier calls to nationalize the huge lithium and copper industries. And Kast's team was explicit. His more controversial conservative social views on things like abortion or gay rights, not part of the program, period.
So they're both focusing on more pragmatic issues like crime and the economy.
Yes, issues where they need broader consensus to act. It suggests a certain resilience in the Chilean system.
Okay, let's bring it back to the U.S. and connect back to that theme of economic fragility, particularly for military families. The shutdown highlighted some ongoing issues there.
It really did. Even though service members themselves kept getting paid during the shutdown, many military families operate on very tight budgets already.
Why is that?
Frequent moves make it hard for spouses to maintain careers, so spouse unemployment is incredibly high, around 21% to 23%. Many families rely on a single military income.
And the food insecurity numbers are really concerning.
They are stark. About a quarter of active duty military families experience food insecurity. That's compared to about 13.5% for U.S. households overall. It's nearly double.
So any financial disruption hits them hard and fast.
Immediately. The Journal profiled Alicia Blevins, wife of a Marine corporal. She talked about needing food pantries because a $6,000 reimbursement for moving costs was delayed by the shutdown.
$6,000 is a lot when your budget is already tight.
Exactly. She said they often only have about $350 left after bills each month. So that delay forced them straight to food banks. It just shows how policy gridlock and even just administrative delays can expose the intense financial vulnerability of many families, even those serving the country.
That's a powerful connection between policy failures and household budgets. It's a good place to transition to how these financial pressures and maybe broader social trends are playing out in consumer finance and even cultural issues.
Absolutely. Starting with a potentially big change in how we pay for things with credit cards.
This is about the Visa MasterCard settlement after that long antitrust fight.
That's the one. A settlement has been proposed after basically two decades of legal battles with merchants over those interchange fees, the fees merchants pay every time you swipe a card.
And this settlement could change things at the checkout counter.
Significantly. It gives merchants much more flexibility to charge different prices or add surcharges depending on the type of credit card you use.
So my coffee could cost more if I use my fancy rewards card versus a basic one.
That's exactly the idea. Maybe the latte is $5.10 with a basic card that has a lower fee, say 2.5% surcharge equivalent. But use a high reward card with a higher fee, maybe it's $5.25, reflecting a 3% surcharge. Tiered pricing becomes possible.
What about card acceptance? Can merchants start refusing certain cards?
Yeah, that's the other big potential change. Merchants might be able to pick and choose which categories of cards within a network, like Visa or MasterCard, they accept.
Like the Costco example. They only take Visa now, but they have to take all Visa cards.
Right. Under the settlement, they could theoretically say, we'll accept basic Visa cards, but we're rejecting the super premium, high-fee Visa Infinite cards.
Do analysts think that will actually happen? Will stores start rejecting rewards cards?
They're pretty skeptical for a couple reasons. First, the categories defined in the settlement are apparently quite broad, often grouping mid-tier cards with the really expensive ones, making it hard to target just the highest fees.
And second,
retailers risk really ticking off their best customers, right? The people who spend a lot and use those premium cards specifically for the rewards. Alienating them might not be worth the small saving on fees.
Speaking of the fees, is the settlement actually reducing them much? Will this kill rewards programs?
That seems unlikely, too. The settlement only mandates a pretty small average reduction in interchange fees, just 0.1 percentage points.
0.1%, that's tiny.
And it's phased in over 5 years. Most analysts agree that's nowhere near enough to force banks to gut their lucrative rewards programs or get rid of high annual fees.
Oh, wow.
Because those rewards are often funded by other things, like statement credits from merchants, or they're just a cost of doing business for banks fiercely competing for those valuable high-spending customers. The fundamental economics of rewards cards probably won't change much from this.
Okay, so maybe more transparency on pricing, but the rewards aren't going away.
Yeah.
Got it. Now, shifting from financial health to personal health, there's been a lot of noise and misinformation about antidepressants, SSRI specifically.
A huge amount of noise, and it's become incredibly polarized. You got prominent figures like Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. making claims linking SSRIs to violence, calling them more addictive than heroin.
Which prompted government studies, right?
Yeah, it did. And then on the other extreme, you have social media sometimes portraying them almost as a lifestyle drug, a quick fix for everyday unhappiness. We really need to get grounded in the medical facts here, based on the sources.
Okay, let's tackle the addiction claim first. What do doctors actually say?
They are very clear. Antidepressants are not addictive in the medical sense.
What's the distinction?
Addiction involves things like compulsive use, intense craving, feeling high or intoxicated, and continuing to use despite clear negative consequences. Dr. Dacca in the article said he's never seen a patient exhibit those signs with antidepressants, never seen someone compulsively seek them out.
So what do people experience when they stop taking them? That's real, isn't it?
It is real, but it's different. It's about physical adaptation and then withdrawal symptoms when the medication is stopped, especially abruptly. The body gets used to the drug's effect on serotonin signaling.
Like those ear zaps people report?
Oh, that's one unusual but documented symptom. More commonly, it can feel like a transient flu headache, fatigue, nausea. But even then, a big analysis of over 20,000 patients found only about 15% had any withdrawal symptoms.
And severe symptoms were rare.
Very rare. Only about 3% experienced severe symptoms. The key point doctors stress is this physical adaptation and withdrawal is not the same as psychological addiction.
Okay. What about the link to violence? That's a really serious claim.
It is, and medical experts say there is simply no solid research establishing a direct causal link between taking antidepressants and committing violent acts.
So where does that idea come from?
When severe behavioral problems do occur in someone taking these medications, doctors argue it's far more likely related to the underlying mental illness itself being severe or uncontrolled, not a side effect of the drug causing violence. In fact, they argue the risks of not treating severe depression, which can sometimes involve agitation or impulsive behavior, are much higher than the risks of the medication.
Got it. And finally, how long are people supposed to take these? Is it forever?
It depends. They're prescribed for diagnosed conditions like major depressive disorder, not just feeling down for a week. For a first episode, the typical recommendation is to continue the medication for 6 to 12 months after symptoms have gone into remission to help prevent relapse.
But what about people with recurring depression?
That's different. The risk of having another episode jumps dramatically after multiple episodes, up to 90% risk of recurrence after 3 episodes. For those individuals with chronic or recurrent depression, longer-term use, maybe beyond 2 years or even indefinitely, might be necessary.
Like managing any other chronic health condition.
Exactly, like managing high blood pressure or diabetes. It's about preventing relapse of a serious illness.
That's really helpful clarification, cutting through a lot of the rhetoric. Okay, let's pivot now to broader cultural shifts and opinions. How are people thinking about big life questions like work, family, technology?
Well, there's definitely a rethinking happening around the whole career and family balance, especially for women. That book, Having It All by economist Corinne Lowe, seems to capture this shift.
What's her main argument? Is it a rejection of the lean-in idea?
Very much so. She argues that the whole push for women to just lean in harder at work often just led to burnout and exhaustion.
And she tackles the pay gap directly.
She does. And in a way that might be controversial. She concedes that part of the pay gap exists because, well, many women want to spend time at home with their children. It's a choice, she implies.
And her advice is pretty blunt.
Incredibly blunt. She essentially tells young women to stop romanticizing work. Why? Because your employer, as a rational economic entity, will never love you back. It's a transactional relationship.
Wow. How does she connect this to biology?
She stresses that women face a biological clock. They have to make these huge, often irreversible decisions or bets about family during their 20s and 30s. She even argues, somewhat counterintuitively, that birth control, by extending the dating phase, might actually be costlier for women because it shortens the period of fecundity they have to find a partner and start a family if they want one.
That's a starkly economic and biological view of life choices.
It is. Very utilitarian, focusing on constraints and trade-offs, rejecting the idea you can seamlessly optimize both career and family without making hard choices.
Okay, so from that high-pressure, calculated view of life strategy, we see almost the opposite trend emerging elsewhere, a return to something much slower, more analog, like film photography.
Exactly. It's this fascinating counter-narrative. The demand for old-school analog film is apparently soaring.
And it's mostly younger people driving this, the digital natives.
Primarily people under 35, yeah.
Yeah.
The very generation that grew up with smartphones, instant digital photos, filters, endless retakes.
So why the return to film? What's the appeal?
It seems to be a reaction against digital perfection and instant gratification. People talk about wanting spontaneity, a quality of timelessness that digital photos often lack. And maybe most importantly, what one source called those rare moments of unknowing.
What does that mean?
When you shoot a roll of film, you usually only have 24 or 36 shots. You can't instantly see the results. You have to be more intentional. Think about the shot before you take it, rather than just firing off 100 digital snaps and hoping one works.
It forces mindfulness.
And it creates anticipation. That delay between clicking the shutter and actually seeing the developed photos weeks later, that process makes the final images feel more precious, less disposable than the thousands of photos sitting on our phones.
Is this actually helping companies like Kodak? Weren't they bankrupt?
They were. Kodak filed for bankruptcy back in 2012.
Yeah.
But this analog revival has been a lifeline. They ended 2024 with a cash balance of $201 million, largely thanks to this renewed demand for actual film stock. It's a real turnaround.
So this whole section paints a picture of financial stress for some, intense debates about life paths, and this interesting cultural pull towards authenticity and maybe imperfection. It really captures the mood.
I think so. It's a complex mix of anxieties and aspirations.
Okay, let's round out our deep dive today with a look at culture, media, and the often dramatic world of sports, starting with the return of the SantaCon Grinch.
Yeah, this is a fun one. John Law, he co-created the original SantaCon event way back as part of this anarchic art group called the Cacophony Society.
But he came to hate what it became, the massive drunken pub crawl.
Totally. He apparently grew disillusioned and embarrassed by it and avoided it for like 25 years.
So why did he go back?
He got convinced to participate in the big New York City event in 2022, specifically for a documentary. The director kind of framed it as Dr. Frankenstein confronting his monster.
And what did he think? Did it change his mind?
He had this great realization. He basically concluded that the only thing more annoying than the chaotic mess of SantaCon is being the grumpy old guy who's constantly complaining about SantaCon.
A moment of self-awareness. Sometimes you just have to embrace the chaos.
Exactly. A bit of self-deprecating humor about pop culture, even your own accidental creation.
Okay, speaking of creations and monsters, Hollywood seems to be busy rehabilitating villains, like the Predator.
Right, the new movie Predator. Badlands apparently takes the iconic, super violent, R-rated alien hunter and turns him into a PG-13 hero.
A hero? How?
They even gave him a name, Deck. And apparently he's struggling with family drama. His dad tries to kill him or something. It's a total reimagining.
Did it work? Financially?
It did surprisingly well in opening weekend, about $40 million domestic, which is apparently a record for the franchise.
But does this kind of IP twisting have risks? Making villains cuddly?
That's the strategic question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hollywood is obsessed with leveraging existing IP familiar names,
yeah.
Giving villains sympathetic backstories like the Joker or sanding off the rough edges of characters like the Predator. It definitely broadens the potential audience in the short term.
Right.
Get that PG-13 crowd.
But does it dilute the brand, alienate the original fans who liked the R-rated horror?
That's the risk. You might gain a wider, perhaps shallower audience, but lose the core fan base that made the IP valuable in the first place. It's a constant tension in Hollywood financing right now.
Okay, shifting to music. Rosalía's new album is getting huge buzz.
Massive buzz. Her fourth album, Lux. It's being described as this wildly ambitious big swing.
What's the concept?
Apparently, it's a concept album about female saints with lyrics sung in over a dozen languages, and she recorded parts with the London Symphony Orchestra.
Wow. That sounds potentially difficult to listen to, complex.
You'd think so. It mixes opera, flamenco, hyperpop. The credits list something like 90 different entities involved.
Yeah.
But the reviews say despite that complexity, it's incredibly approachable and human.
How does she pull that off?
Apparently, her voice and the core melodies just cut through all the complexity and connect emotionally, even if you have no idea what the lyrics mean, literally. Critics are calling it a masterpiece that manages to be both incredibly intricate and deeply moving.
Sounds intriguing. And one more cultural mystery, the Shakespeare portrait.
Yeah, there's a PBS documentary called Picturing Shakespeare exploring this painting called the Wadlow Portrait.
And the claim is it might be a portrait of Shakespeare himself painted while he was alive.
That's the tantalizing possibility. It's been in this one family for generations. Mm. Scientific analysis apparently supports the age of the painting.
And the theory is it shows him as an actor.
Possibly playing the ghost of Hamlet's father. There's a portrait mentioned in the play itself.
Mm.
It's fascinating, though the current owner, Stephen Wadlow, is charmingly honest about the necessary wishful thinking involved.
Yeah.
It hung in his parents' living room for 50 years.
A great story. Okay, let's shift now to the high drama of sports. Catastrophes seem to be the theme, starting with Formula One.
Oh, absolute disaster for Ferrari. Their season hit rock bottom in Brazil when both their star drivers, Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton, crashed out of the race.
And this guarantees a long drought for them.
The longest ever since Ferrari started racing 75 years ago. No drivers' championship since 2007. No constructors' titles since 2008. It's a historic low point.
And the blame game started immediately.
Instantly. Ferrari chairman John Elkann came out and basically blamed the drivers, saying they need to focus more and talk less.
Trying to shield the team and the car.
Clearly. But the stats suggest it's more than just driver focus. Hamilton himself called the season a nightmare, and he's been outqualified by his teammate in 16 out of 21 races this year. That usually points to fundamental issues with the car design or team strategy, not just the drivers.
Okay, from the track to the basketball court, an equally dramatic failure in the NBA, the Dallas Mavericks situation.
Yeah, maybe even more clear-cut blame here. The Mavs fired their general manager, Nico Harrison.
And this was just 9 months after he made that huge trade.
The trade, now being called possibly the worst trade in NBA history, sending their superstar, Luka Doncic, to the Lakers.
Why did he do it? What was his rationale?
Harrison, who came from Nike and was close to Kobe Bryant, apparently wanted a different kind of leader, a cutthroat competitor in that Kobe mold.
Even though Doncic had just carried them to the NBA Finals?
Exactly. Harrison insisted the team was still in win-now mode after trading away the generational talent who got them there.
Yeah.
It made no sense to anyone.
And the results were disastrous.
Completely. They started the season 3-8. Fans were chanting, "Fire Nico!" at games constantly. The firing was inevitable. Just a total misread of the team and the player, seemingly driven by a flawed idea about personality types.
Ouch! Okay, before we wrap up with our final thoughts, there's one more important item. A significant conflict within the conservative movement itself centered on the Heritage Foundation.
Right, this is a really interesting ideological and institutional struggle. Heritage, historically one of the most influential conservative think tanks, is facing internal division. High-profile figures like the former president of AEI, Chris DeMuth, have resigned.
And it's over Heritage's partnership with Tucker Carlson.
Specifically, Heritage President Kevin Roberts' forceful defense of that partnership, even after Carlson hosted controversial figures like Nick Fuentes.
Fuentes being the self-avowed anti-Semite.
Yes, who has praised Hitler and made numerous anti-Semitic remarks. Roberts defended the partnership in a video, attacking critics as a venomous coalition of the globalist class. Strong language.
So what's the core criticism from people like DeMuth?
They argue that Heritage, which built its reputation on being a nonpartisan, data-driven policy shop, has basically sacrificed its intellectual independence and core values.
To become what?
To become, as they put it, the enforcer for the party leadership, specifically the Trump wing of the party, prioritizing political allegiance over policy integrity.
And this is seen as a dangerous path for think tanks.
Exactly, a cautionary tale. They argue Heritage is abandoning the old William F. Buckley Jr. tradition of carefully policing the boundaries of conservatism, letting extremist elements in to appease populists. The critics believe the value of these institutions lies in objective analysis and data, not just political cheerleading. By making political loyalty the priority, they argue Heritage is risking its long-term credibility.
A really profound debate about the role and soul of policy institutions in today's political climate.
Absolutely. And it feels like a fitting place to pause before we try to pull together the threads from this incredibly dense day of news.
Okay, let's do that. If we try to summarize the major themes today, what stands out? There's clearly this deep economic uncertainty in the U.S.
Definitely. Defined by that policy paralysis at the head, the unprecedented internal split, and the very real economic damage from the shutdown. And we see that filtering down into caution in the labor market and real financial fragility for many families, including military families.
Right. And then running parallel to that, you have this absolutely breakneck global AI arms race.
Yeah, fueled by these dueling strategies, Anthropic's caution versus OpenAI's hyperaggression, and funded by incredibly complex, maybe even dangerous financial engineering, those Frankenstein financing deals, the speculative debt tied to chip values. It's high-stakes gambling on a massive scale.
And layered underneath all that economic and technological tension, we picked up on these subtler cultural shifts.
Right. That backlash against the lean-in pressure, the advice to stop romanticizing work, paired with that almost nostalgic yearning for something real, something analog, like the film photography revival. It feels like a society grappling with anxiety, technological acceleration, and maybe a search for authenticity.
So, high anxiety, huge tech bets, policy gridlock, that seems to capture it. Now, for our final provocative thought for you, our listener.
We spent a lot of time on the massive financial risks being taken to build out AI infrastructure, those complex debt structures, the guarantees, the bets on the future value of chips.
And we contrasted OpenAI's projection of a $74 billion loss in 2028 with Anthropic's much more cautious path.
So the question to mull over is this. What happens, systemically, if OpenAI's massive bet doesn't pay off? What if that $74 billion loss in 2028 signals that the current AI bubble has definitively burst?
What are the domino effects?
Specifically, think about that highly leveraged speculative debt we discussed. What happens to the banks, to the financial system, when deals like the xAI chip financing, which relies entirely on those NVIDIA chips holding their value for 5 years, suddenly find themselves backing assets worth only a fraction of their initial cost because the whole AI profit story collapsed?
When billions in debt are suddenly backed by millions in assets.
That's the potential systemic shockwave hiding within the intersection of today's speculative technology and extreme financial leverage. That's the gamble.
A sobering thought to end on. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into today's sources.
Always a pleasure.
Until next time.